Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the forthcoming P5 plus 1 talks with Iran, which many see as a last chance for the UN Security Council plus Germany to make a deal with Iran before their elections begin. Flint Leverett and Hilary Mann, co-authors of the new book Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran, join us to discuss the need for the U.S. to rethink its 30-year-long failed policy towards Iran. Then we will speak with the former New York Times UN correspondent Barbara Crissett, who now covers the UN for The Nation, where she has an article, once again, Senate Republicans Reject Human Rights. We will discuss the growing number of treaties on the rights of children, women, and the disabled that the United States has signed but failed to ratify due to the rejectionist bloc of ignorant and isolationist Republican senators who see UN treaties as a plot by foreigners to impose a vast gay, feminist, socialist conspiracy on American life. Then finally, we will speak with Eric LeCompte, the director of the Jubilee USA Network, which focuses on development in relation to the international debt crisis. We will discuss the need to close corporate offshore tax loopholes that deny the United States Treasury $150 billion a year, which is a lot more than the automatic spending cuts that will take place in 2013 if Congress fails to avert the so-called fiscal cliff. Joining us now are Flint Leverett and Hilary Mann Leverett, co-authors of the new book Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Flint Leverett served at the National Security Council, State Department, and CIA, and is currently a professor of international affairs and law at Penn State. Hilary Mann Leverett served at the National Security Council and the State Department and negotiated for the United States government with Iranian officials. She is now a senior professorial lecturer at American University. Their writing has also appeared in the New York Times, Politico, Foreign Policy, and the Washington Monthly, among other publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Flint and Hilary Mann Leverett.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, thank you both, and thank you for your new book, Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And, of course, you're both going to Tehran, are you not, tomorrow?
Tomorrow, that's right.
Well, let's begin with the context that I mentioned in the opening here, that The forthcoming round of P5 plus one talks with Iran, many see as the last chance for the UN Security Council plus Germany to make a deal with Iran before their elections begin and the holidays begin. Do you accept that window is closing?
Well, you know, it's closing because of, you know, arbitrary deadlines and frameworks that the United States and some of its partners have imposed on these negotiations. In the end, the Iranian nuclear problem is actually quite simple. If the United States was prepared to accept Iran's right to enrich uranium under safeguards on its own territory, you could have a deal in fairly short order on the nuclear issue, where you could probably get limits on Iran's 20% enrichment. You could get much more intrusive verification on its nuclear activities. But you would have to accept the Islamic Republic as kind of a normal state with legitimate interests and rights.
And this is the problem that underlies the entire debate now about the potential of negotiations through the P5 plus one, this mechanism of the permanent five members of the Security Council in Germany with Iran. The anxiety here, the urgency, is because, or it's put out, that if we don't do something now, we don't try to make a deal now, the Iranian elections will come and there will be this new year in Iran, and somehow that is going to derail any possibility of talks. This is something that time and time again permeates the American debate, that somehow the problem with negotiating with Iran is in Iran, is in Tehran, that somehow it's either the mad mullahs are either so crazy, so irrational, that we have to we can't count on them to negotiate like a rational state, or various things are going to come up in their calendar, particularly elections, which in itself should make us question this idea that there are mad mullahs there, because they do have regular elections, have had them every few years for a president since the founding of the Islamic Republic. The whole debate here is that something is wrong in Iran, something is wrong in Tehran that's going to derail talks. There's never any examination of what drives American politics to demonize countries like the Islamic Republic of Iran or Iraq before that, or even in current day terms, Libya and Syria. The issue is something here. It's about domestic politics here. If President Obama cannot get a negotiation going with the Iranians in the next few months, he has a problem domestically here, because the domestic constituencies here and the Israeli government will say, time is up. You've had enough time. We can't let the Iranians continue to progress in the nuclear program. You have to take even more coercive action, either more coercive sanctions or military action. It's a domestic problem here. It's not because of something going on in the decision-making or some irrational craziness among Iranian clerics or Iranian lay leaders.
So let me ask Flint Leverett. Is there any substance to the report that came out that Valerie Jarrett had secret talks with the Iranian officials, and that coincided, and that was quickly followed by the decision on the part of the Israelis to escalate the situation in Gaza?
I don't know if those specific talks took place that have been reported took place or not. I mean, I think it is pretty clear that There have been some bilateral contacts on the margins of various meetings where Iranian officials, U.S. officials, have been in attendance. I think that the Israelis are perpetually concerned that I think their concern is exaggerated, but I think they're perpetually concerned that the Obama administration really is going to try in a serious way to pursue a deal, because the Israelis know that the only kind of deal you could really get out of this process that would have any meaning for both sides would be a deal that actually recognized Iran's right to enrich, again, under safeguards, not building a nuclear weapon, but they do have a right to enrich under safeguards. And that's what the Israelis are out to stop. They do not want the United States, other major Western powers, to accept this basic fact of international law and international life, that the Iranians have this right, and they're not going to be bullied into giving it up. And, you know, this is something that I think the United States really has to come to terms with. For its own interests, it needs to get a nuclear deal with Iran. It needs to start realigning its relations with this important country in the Middle East. And, you know, we need to be able to separate Israeli preferences that have more to do with their own commitment to military dominance in the Middle East and Israeli security. You know, Iran enriching uranium under safeguards doesn't affect Israeli security at all. But we need to be able to sort out what our real interests are here.
Well, sorry, Hillary. Go ahead, Hillary.
Yeah, I have no way of knowing whether Valerie Jarrett engaged in these kind of discussions. I have some doubt that there would have been that kind of discussion going on. But there is precedent, and again, one of the reasons why we wrote this book, there is ample precedent of times when the United States and Iran were inching towards discussions, or actually in discussions. And I'm recalling specifically when I was an official with the State Department, then working for the White House, dispatched to go with then Ambassador Ryan Crocker to talk to the Iranians about Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda. This is in the fall of 2001, right after 9/11. We had very constructive, productive talks with the Iranians. They were critical to helping us with the strategy to overthrow the Taliban and to set up a new government in Afghanistan. And then, lo and behold, January 2002 comes. And there is a boat that sails towards the Gaza Strip with 50 tons of weapons on it. The Israelis claim, and this is a claim that's never been followed up after that, claim that that ship came from Iran. That was the basis for which President Bush then designated Iran as part of the Axis of Evil, because they were sending the ship of 50 tons of weapons to the Palestinians in Gaza, notwithstanding the fact that one of my interlocutors on the Iranian side at the time, he was the deputy foreign minister, he went on television to say, he actually went on Fox News to say that ship was not authorized by the Iranian government. He was careful to say that he could not guarantee it didn't come from anywhere in Iran, but that it absolutely was not authorized by the Iranian government. Didn't matter. They were designated as part of the axis of evil. This is the history of the relationship between the United States and Iran. Iran has consistently engaged in talks with the United States when the United States requested it, over Afghanistan, over Iraq, over Bosnia, over Lebanon. And in each case, the United States benefits from that engagement. The Iranians don't do 100% of what we ask, but they do a lot, and we benefit. But then something else happens, whether it's the Israelis, whether it's an election in Iran that people perceive as fraudulent when there's not a basis to do so, but they still perceive it. Whatever it is, there's something that periodically comes up, routinely comes up, to derail those talks. And what Flint and I argue in the book, that because of this history, it's critically to understand it as it is, not for how some may wish it to be, and then what do you do about that, where periodic talks over issues of mutual interest, that doesn't work to transform the relationship. And clearly, sanctions don't work to transform the relationship. We are convinced that military action against Iran is not going to work to transform the relationship. So what can you do? And this is where Flint and I unpack, we think pretty persuasively, the precedent of President Nixon and Kissinger going to Beijing. And there's the title for our book, Going to Tehran. That for the United States to deal with its interests in the Middle East, to save our position in the Middle East, we can't just work with Iran here or there or try to cut a deal on the nuclear issue or cut a deal on whatever issue of the day. But we have to have a fundamental realignment, a rapprochement with the Islamic Republic of Iran that accepts it as a rational state, looking at its interests to protect them as it sees them, and that we can work with that in the Middle East to stabilize the region and restore our own position.
Flint, you're leaving tomorrow for Tehran, and my understanding is that since October of 2009, Tehran has refused to engage in bilateral talks with American diplomats, perhaps believing that that's a concession, which is pretty much the way we operate, I'm afraid. But there's been some rather candid revelations from Iranian government institutions recently talking about why Iran should not shun direct talks. So is there a breakthrough likely there, or are they going to stick with the P5+1 mechanism?
I think that the Iranians, that their position on dealing with the United States has been pretty clear and consistent for a long time, for years. They are open to improved relations. They are open to dialogue and diplomacy to facilitate serious improvement in relations, but they want to know up front at this point that the United States is really prepared to accept the Islamic Republic as a legitimate political order representing legitimate national interests, and they want to know up front that the United States is really serious about realigning relations with it. They're not interested in having negotiations just for the sake of having negotiations. They're not interested in having negotiations if they think that the United States is simply just going to keep piling sanctions on them. You know, they want to know up front that the United States is serious. So they will go to the P5+1 talks. They certainly are not, refusing to participate in the P5+1 process. And if, as part of that, the United States makes it clear that it really is interested in a different sort of relationship, that it really does accept the Islamic Republic and wants to come to terms with it as an important player in the Middle East, I think at that point the Iranians would be very, very open, very receptive to bilateral dialogue.
Well, Hillary, it appears that, at least if these reports are correct, that some government institutions are talking about why, and they have political assessments arguing that Iran should not shun direct talks. So is there a division going on there within the government? I mean, clearly there's a division between the speaker and the president.
Well, I think there is consensus that Iran should and can engage with almost any country in the world if it is to protect its own interests. Where it draws the line is anywhere where Iran would be asked to or expected to cede any of its sovereign rights. That Iran it's not going to agree to that kind of negotiation up front. In terms of what Iran should push for, what kind of deal Iran can make in the end, there's certainly discussion, debate, really vociferous debate in Iran about those kind of tactics. But the strategy that Iran is a strong country, it can and should negotiate and deal with other countries in its own interest, is something that is really put forward by the Supreme Leader, by Ayatollah Khamenei, and it's something I think every senior official follows. There's no real dissent in Iran about that. It's really just over tactics. You hear in Washington especially periodic discussion about how, you know, some days it's Ahmadinejad is the hardliner and he would never be able to deal with the United States. And then someone points out, well, you know, he actually wrote a 20-page letter to Bush. He actually wrote a congratulatory letter to President Obama upon his first election. Then people say, well, then maybe the issue really is the Speaker of the Parliament, or it's this person, or it's that person. There's a constant attempt in the United States, particularly in Washington, to try to read the tea leaves as if it's a very opaque system. People analogize it, these kind of critics analogize it to the Soviet system. But it's not really opaque. If you listen to, read, talk to officials, talk to a range of people in Iran's political class on the political spectrum, and take what they have to say seriously, not as if they're being forced to say something, you can really understand their strategy. You can understand where they're coming from, and the strategic determination to be a very strong, independent country. The problem, I think, on our side, why we try to always see where there's some daylight, see where that this person is competing with that person, is that we're very reluctant to accept that Iran could be a strong, independent, not secular, not liberal, but still legitimate political entity. That is something that is deep in American culture, is very, very hard to accept. So I think rather than there being so many divisions on the Iranian side that people put out there paralyzes the Iranians, that, in fact, is not the case. And we document exhaustively in our book the number of times that the Iranians have engaged with the United States. In the 1980s over Lebanon, we actually have a name for it. It was called the Iran-Contra scandal. The Iran-Contra scandal failed not because the Iranians were divided, not because the Iranians couldn't come to the table, but because our own officials skirted Congress and broke the law by diverting proceeds from the sale of weapons to Iran to Nicaragua. I mean, it sounds crazy now in retrospect, but that's the history. The Iranians came to the table with us in the 1980s over Lebanon. They then helped us to get weapons to the Muslims in Bosnia in the 1990s. I then worked personally with them as an official in the State Department and in the White House with a team of a small team of American officials to deal with Afghanistan, the problem we were facing there after 9/11 with Al-Qaeda. Every single time the Iranians have come, they were not paralyzed by internal conflict. The internal conflict was here. It's the opposition that I had when I was in the White House from my superiors or people who worked for Vice President Cheney trying to undermine what Ryan Crocker and I were doing with the Iranians. It wasn't a problem on the Iranian side.
Well, Hillary, didn't after the U.S. Invasion of Iraq in the war that was largely prosecuted, or at least engineered in many ways, by Dick Cheney, and of course President Bush was the president, notwithstanding, my understanding is that shortly after Baghdad fell, that the Iranians sent missives through, I think, the Swiss to the White House saying that we would like to talk and everything's on the table. And that includes this nuclear program that we're so exercised about. And apparently Dick Cheney basically said, we don't talk to evil, and scrubbed the whole, and just rejected it out of hand. Is that true?
Well, we were having quieter talks. Ryan Crocker and I, and a couple of others in the State Department, were having quieter talks with Iranian officials up until the invasion of Iraq. Then, there were some issues on our side. The invasion happened. My superiors, including Vice President Cheney, thought we were riding high with the invasion of Iraq and the fall of Baghdad. But instead of just cutting off those talks clearly in a transparent way, there was a bombing, an al-Qaeda bombing in Riyadh and in Casablanca, twin bombings at the exact same time in May 2003. Then Defense Secretary Rumsfeld said, and of course this has never been followed up on or checked, that there was some intercept from somewhere that showed that one of the bombers in Saudi Arabia called someone in Iran and said the job was done. That was then used to cut off talks with the Iranians that Ryan Crocker and I were having over Afghanistan and al-Qaeda and trying to have them over Iraq, cut them off and really destroyed them for years to come. In, I think, an attempt to try to rescue the talks, the Iranians remarkably put in writing, for one of the first time that I had seen, put in writing how instead of just dealing with Afghanistan or Iraq or al-Qaeda, these issues in an isolated way, that the way to restore, to have trust, to restore the relationship between the United States and Iran on a productive level of equals, would be this broad-based, comprehensive engagement, like what Kissinger and Nixon did with China. And, you know, we called it the grand bargain. I actually wrote the memo. I was, by this point, on the policy planning staff at the State Department, wrote the memo to then-Secretary of State Colin Powell, including this note from the Iranians that laid out what this comprehensive discussion, negotiation, and eventually grand bargain would look like, and advocated that we should take it. Flint had the opportunity to meet with a very senior official from on the Iranian side at about that same time in Athens, and I included his minutes from that meeting. I gave it to my boss, who gave it to Colin Powell. I saw Colin Powell a couple weeks later, and even though the memo was longer than what he normally would read, and let me know that, he thought it was an excellent memo, but that he couldn't sell it at the White House. I later learned that he couldn't sell it, but in fact what Cheney put forward was not just that Cheney, vice president, he's the boss, but that if Colin Powell, if the State Department would just let this Iran issue go for a while, then Cheney would look more favorably on the six-party talks restarting over North Korea. Well, Powell took that deal, and those talks proceeded. The talks with Iran went into the deep freeze for years. And the Iranians, you know, just got stronger and stronger in Iraq. We went deeper into a quagmire. Finally, again, 4 years later in 2007, by this point, my colleague Ryan Crocker was our ambassador in Baghdad. He was allowed finally to start talking to the Iranians again, but over an extremely narrow, restricted agenda. And by this point, the Iranians thought that wasn't really serious. They would protect their own interests in Iraq, help us where they could, but basically protect their own interests. And that's one of the reasons why today they are focused on this kind of comprehensive approach where they're not just strung along and then cut off and punished when either there's a change of administration here or something else comes up.
I thank you both for joining us.
Thank you very much.
It's
really
been our pleasure.
It. Yes.
Again, I've been speaking with Flint Leverett and Hilary Mann Leverett, co-authors of the new book, Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Flint Leverett served at the National Security Council, State Department, and CIA, and is currently a professor of international affairs and law at Penn State University. Hilary Mann Leverett served at the National Security Council, the State Department, and negotiated for the U.S. government with Iranian officials. She is now a senior professorial lecturer at American University, and their writing has also appeared in the New York Times, Politico, Foreign Policy, and the Washington Monthly, among other publications. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the rejectionist bloc of U.S. senators holding up treaties involving the rights of children, women, and the disabled that the United States has already signed. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Barbara Crissette, who is a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine and author of several books on Asia. She was the New York Times' chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia from 1984 to 1991, and later the Times bureau chief at the United Nations. She has also been a diplomatic correspondent in Washington and a reporter in Central America and the Caribbean and Canada. She has an article at The Nation, Once Again, Senate Republicans Reject International Human Rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barbara Crissette.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you again.
And just last week, there was a shocking display of ignorance in the United States Senate. It reminded me of Dean Acheson's remark, Truman's Secretary of State, referring to the primitives. But the primitives came out in spite of the appearance of Bob Dole in a wheelchair, wheeled in by his wife, who was also a United States senator. And then you had John McCain arguing on behalf of the bill to extend the rights of disabled, an American-modeled bill that the United Nations had taken up in the international arena. And, of course, of the two-thirds requirement under a treaty, they failed because of Rick Santorum managed to get enough of his colleagues to vote against it. Where's the shame, though? I mean, clearly, Senator Kerry was furious, but I don't get the sense in this country that enough people recognize this shameful behavior.
No, I think partly it is because most people in this country don't seem to also understand how the United Nations works, and that's an issue we could talk about for hours at another time. And so when there is a great deal of sort of ignorance across the public about the United Nations system, there's plenty of negative things said about it. There are crazy things said about it. Just today I read that Michelle Bachmann, who is everyone's favorite on the right from time to time, is saying that, you know, that Hillary Clinton and others in the administration are trying to work with the UN, just to make a long story short, to basically abolish the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. This is the kind of thing that gets out there. And because people don't know how the UN works, very often it finds fertile field, you know, and so people believe these things. This is part of the problem. So, you know, if you don't know how ignorant, as John Kerry was trying to point out, how ignorant you are, you know, there isn't sort of room for shame.
Well, but it wasn't always this way. In fact, the United Nations, of course, began in San Francisco and its headquarters are in New York. And in 1948, the landmark Universal Declaration of Human Rights was passed with Eleanor Roosevelt leading the U.S. delegation. The only two countries that didn't sign the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights were Saudi Arabia and apartheid South Africa. So something's happened to the United States in its role there.
Yeah, yes, it has. I agree. Over the years, a lot of things have happened, and there's been a lot of denial of what has happened and instead of an ability to work with it. One thing is that after the end of the colonial era, really the majority of UN nations now come from the developing world. That is the world. We are no longer, you know, the world in every way. So when developing nations took votes that seemed to be anti-American, this built up. There was the Zionism is racism resolution, which was finally overturned, I think, in the late 1990s. But various blocks of people in this country were alienated. I don't think much about the UN is taught in schools anymore. The model UN system, I think, has serious flaws and is pretty superficial. So all these things have come together, it seems, and Americans have simply drifted away, and maybe from internationalism. It got even worse, I think, after the end of the Cold War, because then there was sort of no focus, and so there was very little attention. Do you know, you might already know this, but most of the major media organizations have taken full-time correspondents out of the United Nations.
And just to give our audience a perspective on how much the U.S. has become an outlier in the United Nations because of this xenophobia and parochialism and isolationism in the United States Senate that ratifies treaties largely from the South and from the religious right. In the case of the treaty that the U.S. Senate rejected last week, of course, Rick Santorum came in and brought in his severely disabled daughter to argue against a treaty that would have extended, it was called the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, it would have extended U.S. law to become international law, and yet he managed, in fact, to lie about what this treaty contained, saying that the treaty would replace in the United States the rights of parents who have the power under current law over their children, if you will, even though, in fact, the treaty says the opposite. So just to give a sense of how much this is about ideology, dogma, and ignorance, do you think that Santorum really believes that this treaty was doing what he says it was doing when it was doing the opposite, or is he just lying?
Speaking out of ideology, I think that's what it is. You know, he's a former senator now, and that makes it all the more, one could say, disgraceful that he had this much influence. He in fact, has been working on this theme earlier on in the year, too. He may believe it. He may be driven by ideology, but he certainly has no excuse for saying the things that he said, because he was a senator. He is a person who wants to be president. And for heaven's sakes, he simply misstated, and I think maliciously, but then that's a personal opinion, the intent and the actual language in this convention. And as you say, this was based a lot on the model that the United States has provided the world with how we look after people with disabilities. Not perfectly, but very well.
Well, my understanding that the reason that Santorum and the rejectionists had 38 votes was that they were afraid of the homeschooling lobby, which is a part of the religious right, I guess. How in God's name did that get into the mix?
Well, a lot of things get into the mix. Something called the Friday Facts, which comes out from a Catholic organization that has an outpost at the UN, also sees in every one of these treaties that they, as I wrote, said in their aha moment, it had the word sexual and reproductive rights. In other words, disabled people have the right to a sex life and, you know, being a parent and marriage and whatever else. They see that as somehow, I don't know, forcing abortion on the world. I mean, it's inexplicable, or that this has something to do with gay and lesbian rights and that the feminists are taking over. There's always some sort of underpinning, and the homeschool movement, it is true, and the United Nations has never had anything to say that I know of, even through UNESCO, about homeschooling.
Now, let's just talk a little about what this rejectionist crowd, as I mentioned, that fit into the category that Dean Acheson, the former Secretary of State under Harry Truman, referred to as the primitives, the power and effect that they've had in denying the U.S. government's ability to ratify these treaties that the U.S. have signed. I'll just go through this list that's in your article at The Nation. The Convention on the Rights of the Child, Only the United States, Somalia, and South Sudan are the holdouts. The Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, which 187 of the 193 UN members have signed, putting the United States on the side of nations like Iran and Sudan. And of course, outside of the human rights arena, you have the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, the Rome Statute, creating the International Criminal Court, which the United States in effect created, but is not a member. And then, of course, the Law of the Sea Treaty. So, you know, it's one thing to sort of laugh at the absurdity of these people, but it's another thing when you recognize, when you just go through that list of treaties that haven't been ratified but have been signed by the United States, you recognize the power of these rejectionists.
The power of the rejectionists. And, you know, for people who, it's paradoxical. At the same time, they're talking about how America has lost its place in the world or how we no longer influence other nations. Well, even our best friends are dismayed by this this rejectionist position, which, and I might say, for a number of years, presidents of both parties have refused, on political grounds, to fight, and that that has played a part in this too. In other words, not giving up your political capital, your poker chips, in order to press for these things, and then of course taking it to the public. I don't think many people follow these things or write to the. Write to their members of Congress, senators or representatives. So there's no pressure on them to think again.
But do they see the obvious intellectual inconsistency? And perhaps that's asking for too much. But if the United States is finding itself in rejecting these treaties, particularly about the rights of women and children, in bed with South Sudan, Somalia, Iran, and Sudan, and Saudi Arabia, I imagine, too, on some of them. Doesn't that undercut the entire message of this chest beating over the war on terror and all these countries that are on America's axis of evil list? How can you be in bed with people that you're fighting a war against?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, and as I was saying earlier, how can you both want to be a world leader and then want to stand back from the world? Because the world is very different now, as I said. There are a different range of countries that have to be dealt with. Numerically, they are the majority in the world. There are all kinds of things going on that are behind a lot of the ignorance. But I think now it's further dropped into sheer partisanship. I'm just reading today while I was waiting to talk to you, led by a senator from, representative from Alabama, an effort to block all the immediate aid to the victims of the Hurricane Sandy disaster. A bitterly partisan thing. People are without houses and things in New Jersey and New York. A bipartisan group of governors went down to Washington. But, you know, even for fellow Americans who are in terrible shape, you get a Republican front against doing anything that could possibly help the president.
What is their objection to helping their fellow Americans who have been the victims of this storm?
Well, and by the way, in the piece I'm reading, it was also mentioned that how quickly a Republican Congress was able to, the Congress in general, it wasn't just a Republican Congress, passed the bill for $62.3 billion in relief for Hurricane Katrina in a matter of weeks. They're now talking about putting this off till next year. They say that in a 77-page plan, they're accusing Governor Cuomo and Governor Christie of not proving that the $60 million, which is less, which the president has requested, is for immediate needs. Now, when people don't have houses, the subway isn't working in parts of the city, I see this as a kind of different stage. In other words, people who don't really know about the intense urban life of a city like New York, talking from Alabama about what is needed up here. I mean, you know, it's in a way the same mentality, and there are going to be other things. But my interest in writing that piece originally too was, apart from the terrible performance over the Disabilities Convention, the idea that this was sending a signal to President Obama, don't bother sending any of these other things up for us because they're going to all get blocked. And that's bad because many people, including our allies and friends in Europe and Asia and Latin America, were thinking in the second term of President Obama, the United States could finally catch up with the world.
Well, but you think, though, that the president could make a case and rally the American people. We've got an election coming up in 2014, and if the Republicans get organized as they did in 2010, they may actually increase their hold in the House and even in the Senate. So there's no reason to think that the battle is over because Obama won. To my mind, that somebody has to step up and tell the progressives and the reasonable people in this country that they've got to vote in greater numbers because the Christian nutcases out there that are living in the 14th century and they want to turn America into the Taliban, they vote in lockstep. And, you know, they're going to do all this damage as long as they all show up at the polls.
Well, you know, I think it's a legitimate criticism, and it certainly was in the first 4 years of the Obama administration, that the White House has not played Congress terribly well. And that one would have thought with Joseph Biden in there as vice president, who's got years and years on the Hill, there would be more, I don't know, some people have accused the president of not schmoozing. Other people have simply said they don't have a team that's working with Congress all the time. And he, as I said, has been careful about expending political capital on some of these issues where the Republicans have already said, as Jesse Helms used to say, send that up here and it's dead on arrival. But also, you've got to figure now he's involved in these very serious fiscal negotiations. And so right at this moment, it may be unfair to say so, but the pattern has been, and the reason perhaps the Obama victory was not greater, was that the White House was not really managing Congress in the way that some other presidents have.
But apropos my point, Barbara, less people voted, as critical as last election was, and many people were terrified at the idea of Romney becoming president and the Supreme Court shifting far to the right because Robert Bork would be choosing Romney's nominees. For all of that angst that was expressed, still less people voted in this last election than did in the 2004 election between Bush and Kerry.
Yeah, and that's so. And I don't. What do you think? Why did this happen?
Well, I just think there's a continual erosion of a responsibility on the part of the left in this country, that they are irresponsible and feel alienated and allowing the right wing to take over.
Yeah, I mean, one could say that the left is, of course, divided, and maybe the right will be, too, before the fiscal crisis is over. But there's strong opinions, but the left did stay together. They didn't field another candidate. In the end, various strong voices said, "Don't do it." I mean, don't destroy the Obama campaign. And toward the end, I didn't hear much at this end of the country anyway that was undermining. But throughout the year, there was quite a lot of criticism of Obama. And you know, maybe one can say the people on the left don't easily fall into line. I don't know.
Right. Well, maybe I'm just influenced by being at Pacifica, where a lot of people reject electoral politics and feel alienated and feel that the world is controlled by five white men in a back room and that there's nothing you can do.
That's interesting, because isn't that a complete mirror image of people who think the world is controlled by crazy socialists out there who you know, who are going to take away our sovereignty and all that stuff. I mean, it's tragic, and it's even more tragic because there are so many wavering democracies around the world, and the United States is the obvious country that has been doing this for several hundred years. And so, you know, that the others can use the help for new problems, for global crises, for everything else. And so it's particularly frightening if the United States has both a rejectionist front and others who just don't want to work in politics anymore or in international organizations, that it's happening. It's happening not just here. It's happening in other countries as well.
Well, Barbara Cassett, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Barbara Cassett, who is a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine and author of several books on Asia. She was the New York Times' chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia, and later the Times bureau chief at the United Nations. She's also been a diplomatic correspondent in Washington and a reporter in Central America, the Caribbean, and Canada. She has an article at The Nation, "Once Again, Senate Republicans Reject International Human Rights."
Everything we need, and I will care for you, 'cause you care for me, and we all have opinions. Some of them get through, but there's better people with more good to do, good to do.
Bermuda in the Bahamas, Front Street Hamilton, they doing more.
We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how to close offshore tax loopholes through which corporate America is avoiding $150 billion a year in taxes. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Eric LeCompte, who's the director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations advocating for solutions to the international debt crisis. Jubilee USA Network has won critical global financial reforms and more than $130 billion in debt relief for the world's poorest countries so the money could be reinvested in social infrastructure. He currently focuses on development in relationship to the international debt crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric LeCompte.
Great. Thanks, Ian. It's great to be on your show today.
And you're calling for the U.S. corporations to pay the $150 billion in taxes that they avoid every year through offshore tax loopholes, arguing that this would more than cover the $109 billion in automatic spending cuts that are set to begin in January the 1st of 2013 if the Congress fails to avert the so-called fiscal cliff. Are they listening to you, Eric?
Well, I think so, Ian. And, I mean, the way you're framing it is exactly right. You know, just yesterday, the White House has said they very much want to see corporate tax reform and offshore tax loopholes be a part of the negotiation over the fiscal cliff. And, you know, from our perspective at Jubilee USA, a faith-based organization, we agree 100%. You know, the reality of it is that 83 of the top 100 public traded corporations that are in the United States, 83 of them are hiding their profits and their earnings abroad. They're hiding their profits and their earnings abroad outside of the United States in tax havens. And our position at Jubilee USA is that, you know, we really need to look at closing these tax havens. And that's for, you know, a number of reasons. You know, number one, here in the United States, if those tax havens were to close, what it would mean is that there would be $150 billion in additional revenue for the United States, and that far outweighs the concerns about the fiscal cliff, which is only $109 billion.
Well, it's interesting. Some of these corporations that you mentioned, of the 83 of the top 100 publicly traded corporations in the United States who use these tax havens, they include Walmart, Coca-Cola, and Pfizer. I just did a forum last night at the UCLA Hammer Forum here in Los Angeles. We had a couple of the most leading tax experts in the country, one who worked for the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and the other is David K. Johnston, who is considered one of the leading experts on U.S. taxes, written a number of bestsellers about it. And David made the point about exactly what you're talking about, and he actually used the example of Pfizer. It turns out that Pfizer, of course, based upon another product that got into trouble called Fen-Phen, were able to isolate a formula which became the infamous blue pill, the triangle-shaped blue pill that men take and sometimes are warned, have an erection for 4 hours. So, you know, it is one of the most popular medications in the world. It goes, I think, for like $18 a pill. So Pfizer are making a fortune out of this drug called Viagra. They apparently simply, Pfizer New Jersey just took the formula of this drug, sent it to Pfizer Switzerland, and headquartered the drug in Pfizer Switzerland. So all of the revenues go to Pfizer Switzerland, even though the bank accounts for Pfizer are still, you know, in the United States. So it's a complete fiction.
You're right. And that's a great, great, great example, because what it does illustrate is like Pfizer, Coca-Cola, Walmart, Microsoft, Bank of America, they keep, and all these corporations keep more than 70% of their cash offshore. In other words, they keep more than 70% of their cash offshore, and they keep all of their earnings offshore. So they keep it offshore to prevent it from being taxed in any way. And at Jubilee USA, you know, we're very concerned about this behavior in the United States as well as globally. In the United States, because they've continued to do this, what it's meant for the average taxpayer is that we've paid more than $434 a year, each of us, average taxpayers, in order to cover General Electric, and all these other corporations from paying taxes here in the United States. So not only are they avoiding taxes, they're forcing all of us to pay more taxes.
Again, I'm speaking with Eric Lecomte, who's the director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations advocating for solutions to the international debt crisis. Jubilee USA Network has won critical global financial reforms and more than $130 billion in debt relief for the world's poorest countries, money which could be reinvested in social infrastructure. He currently focuses on development in relation to the international debt crisis. And when you mentioned how much money corporations are stashing abroad in terms of their profits, the most recent figures that have been given on how much cash corporate America is sitting on here in the United States were about $1.6 trillion. But my understanding is that it's more like $5 to $6 trillion if you count in how much overseas money they have that they're hiding overseas. And when you think about our economic distress at the moment and the need to stimulate the economy in order to start generating revenues to avoid this so-called fiscal cliff and to deal with the looming deficit, you realize the absolute lack of economic patriotism that corporate America has.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think the reality of it is even when we look globally, because of how corporations hide their profits, because of how they refuse to pay taxes throughout the world, we understand is not only is this an issue in the United States, but even in the developing world. The developing world is losing $160 billion per year in taxes. You know, this revenue would certainly dwarf the international debt crisis. They're losing that money because there's not taxes. And, you know, here in the United States, when we're looking at these issues, every $10 that as taxpayers here in the United States, every $10 that we give to the developing world in aid, we see that $10 go in but there is more than $15 what leaves what leaves those countries, more than $15 what leaves those countries in terms of what should have been fairly taxed. So, you know, we're pushing development aid in particular countries around the world, but at the end of the day, that development aid is only going so far, and we're losing what should be revenue in those countries.
Well, if you look at the global tax picture, Eric Lecompte, and who pays taxes and who doesn't, obviously corporate America is a huge villain here. And as you point out, even the $150 billion is probably a low figure that they avoid per year. And what that would do, helping the U.S. avert this so-called fiscal cliff in 2013, The New York Times on Thursday is carrying a story pointing out how, for example, Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has been sentenced to 4 years in jail for tax fraud. But one of the shocking things about this article in the New York Times is that in Pakistan, 67% of members of parliament and 62% of the ministers in the cabinet, in the very government of Pakistan, don't file tax returns. So the U.S. is not the only villain here. The tax avoidance seems to be an international problem.
That's right. It's a global problem. And if we look in terms of the developing world, over the last 10 years, $6.5 trillion has left the developing world completely untaxed. And so part of the reason that we're working right now in the fiscal cliff in the United States is we believe if we're able to address corporate issues, if we're able to address offshore tax loopholes, if we're able to address this kind of behavior, this sends a message globally. And this message globally is so important right now, because the reality of it is that throughout the world, this kind of behavior keeps poor people poor. So our perspective is that by addressing this behavior now, by sending a message here in the United States, we're also sending a message globally in terms of how tax havens should be used and how tax avoidance hurts the poor.
Well, the statistic here is that for every $10 a country receives in development aid, $15 exits that country as a result of tax dodging.
That's right, yeah. And I think that's, from our perspective, that's a huge, huge, huge concern. As much aid as we're giving, it's essentially useless when compared to the amount of money that's leaving the country because of these tax havens and illicit financial flows. And if we really are serious about development, if we're really serious about helping the poor, we have to address tax havens and these financial flows.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Eric Lecompte.
Ian, I can't thank you enough. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Eric Lecompte, who's the director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations advocating for solutions to the international debt crisis. Jubilee USA Network has won critical global financial reforms and more than $130 billion in debt relief for the world's poorest countries, so the money could be reinvested in social infrastructure. He currently focuses on development in relation to the international debt crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and I'll answer your questions as best I can. The conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.